This podcast is recorded on stolen and unceded Aboriginal land.
We acknowledge the First Nations and elders of this country, and we join their calls for justice.
Dear Mr. Chandler Mather, I write to congratulate you on your no doubt imminent declaration as the newly elected member for Griffith.
Whoop-de-fucking-do. That's the subtext. Go on.
Look, this is Terry Butler's concession letter to Max. I don't know if we want to read the whole thing.
As your predecessor and your constituent, and you'll be receiving many more letters from me as a constituent, I wish you well as you assume your responsibilities and seek to deliver on all of the commitments that you have made.
Yeah.
As to the practicalities of a new position, I am certain that Mr. Bant will be ready and willing to give you any relevant practical information about the idiosyncrasies of working within the Commonwealth system. As to the position's responsibilities, it is worth observing that every MP defines the office of MP anew, as circumstances, temperament, and inclination demand. Accordingly, I will not provide any gratuitous advice about how to discharge your work as an MP. I will, however, wish you good luck. Yours faithfully.
Yours faithfully.
Terry Butler.
Terry Butler. Look, I don't think there's any mysteries as to what the subtext is there, what she's really feeling. She used a similar line in all of her media statements too, where she was like, I wish the new member well. She wouldn't say his name. I wish the new member well in delivering on all of the promises he has made, which... Anyway, we also, like, the greatest mystery is what is the tweet above the one where she posted that concession letter that was deleted? Any ideas?
This tweet was deleted by the tweet author. Learn more. And when you click that, it doesn't tell you what the tweet was. Oh, and now her Twitter account just says available for lunch.
Which, to her credit, quite funny.
I like that. That's really good. Funny.
Yeah, I like
that. She still lists her website as terrybutlermp.com. And we're got to update that one, Terry.
It is true, though. Like, you can imagine losing your seat. I'm sure it's like a gut-wrenching experience. But
there'd
also be a moment of relief where you're like, oh, my God, I'm not the fucking MP anymore. Thank fuck.
Don't have to worry about that. Look, I have a level of begrudging respect for anyone who goes on election night coverage whose, like, side is losing. Like, you know, even Liberals who have to sit there as they are being decimated and trounced through the election results, have to sit there and continue to provide commentary on the results and just really explain exactly how badly you're losing. Like, I got to respect that. I think that's quite good. But it was quite a trend across a lot of the, like, Frydenberg wouldn't say Monique Ryan's name either. They refused to say their name. It's like, the election's over. You're not going to give them any extra coverage. They've already beaten
yeah.
You.
I don't think that even, I think Julian Simmons, like, last I checked, hadn't even, you know, contacted Libby to say congratulations and good luck. I think he, like, finally, maybe in the last day or two, posted about it. And, yeah, I haven't read his post, but I'm sure it was similarly petulant.
If you really want to see how to concede a seat, just look up the Federal Greens MPs and what they say when they lose an election. Oh, wait. It hasn't happened.
Australia woke up this week to a new political reality.
Well, the Greens have claimed a fourth seat.
I'm Stephen Bates. I'm the member-elect for the seat of Brisbane, which is the first time I've said that out loud. That's very exciting.
Frankly, I've always found the Greens to be a real serious danger to Australia.
Serious danger to Australia.
Serious Danger. It's a podcast about green politics in Australia. It's not an official Greens Party podcast. We're independent, losers. Sucked in. I'm Tom Ballard. With me is Emerald Moon. This is made possible with the help of the Green Institute and produced by the Griff, Michael Griffin. This week's special guest co-host is the incoming member for Griffith, Max Chandler Mather.
Max.
Welcome to the show. Fucking congratulations, comrade. You did it. Are you tired of winning yet?
Yes.
Absolutely not. Great to be back with the podcast that single-handedly won the election for the Greens.
Thank
you for finally saying it.
Finally,
someone had to admit it. Someone had to put it on the table and be honest about the source of the Green success.
We're the ones who convinced all those Melburnians to move to Brisbane. That was us. We put that call out there. That's the only reason that the Greens won, because
our strategy paid off.
Victorians. All right, we're going to talk to lots of things with Max, obviously. But firstly, I want to say a huge, huge thank you to the more than 40 patrons that came on board in the wake of the green slide. It was a green slide. It was a serious danger patron slide. It's more winning, and you fucking love to see it. 40 people getting on board, chipping in, you know, from $3 a month up to 10 or 20 bucks a month. It's amazing. We really appreciate your support. There are too many names and messages to read out here. Here's a quick one from Kyle. Hey, friends, just want to say big thanks for everything you do. Serious Danger is one of my favorite listens. Fuck you, Kyle.
Wow, and I really appreciate it.
The effort you put into the show. Your passion is infectious, and thanks to you guys, I was able to convince my mum to vote one for the Greens in the election yesterday. Much love. How about that, Emerald?
Cute. That's so, so cute. And because we love our patrons so much, and now there are so many of you, we kind of feel like we should probably do something for you again. So we will be doing another patron-only episode coming out very soon. We will let you all know. I'm going to talk about the spicy stuff that we only put behind the paywall, like factions and Three Pillar Greens.
Is that so, the Courier Mail and the Australian journos have to at least, pay you a little bit of money before they cancel you, or,
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, $3 and you can get a beautiful hit piece on the Greens. That's great value for money, let's be honest.
I think you should raise that. There should be, $100 for a hit piece.
Yeah. Maybe we should up it. You're right.
Oh, Max, you won it. Let's talk about it. Let's talk about victory. We laughed for an hour on last week's show. I've been laughing all week myself. We've been having a wonderful time. We should say at time of recording, we're looking pretty good in the seat of Brisbane, which would bring us to 4 MPs in the lower house for the Greens. But it's still, we're not jinxing it or anything. Maybe you'll know the results by the time you hear this podcast. I don't know. But it looks like potentially Stephen Bates could get up. Is that your general read, Max? That we're in a good position?
Cautiously optimistic at time of recording. But, I would much rather be in our position than Labor's right now in the seat of Brisbane. And they're extremely, extremely keen to get Stephen Bates into Parliament along with the rest of us. It'd be brilliant.
Yeah. Weren't you, who was saying, and I think someone pointed out that Stephen, being a RAFU member, could potentially beat Madonna Jarrett, who I knew that she was the head of Deloitte or something, but was she also head of the Shoppies Union, of the SDA?
No, not the SDA. I thought it was the Retail Owners Association or something like that.
Retail Owners Association. So it's worse even.
Something like that. I can't remember exactly what it was.
Yeah. Well, hope he wins.
I know. There's a poetic justice to that. But no, feeling very good. I mean, it's we've been doing it's so funny because for a long time we spent in the lead up to this election and probably the few years beforehand trying to convince the media that what we were doing and the project that we were rolling out in Queensland was going to eventually be successful, but also was something relatively unique and relating to politics in a particularly unique way. And no one, apart from, admittedly, there was a handful of journalists who did believe, actually, from a surprising number of outlets, but it's so funny. This week has just been a wave of media. I felt, honestly, I've done more media.
Are you okay, Max?
What was that?
Are you okay? Because I've, just fully, I feel a little guilty about this, but I'm I'm going on holiday and I have shit to do, so I just okay, bye, everyone, and just dumped all of this media on everyone else. So I hope that you've had a little bit of rest.
Not yet, but I suppose that'll be coming soon. I mean, it's good to take the opportunity to describe to the rest of the country what's been going on here, and how much hard work it's taken from a lot of people. But honestly, I feel like the result probably surprised some of us as well, just the scale of it.
Surprised me.
When did you know on election night? Was there a moment when you're holy shit, it's goddamn happened, we've done it, or were you holding your breath the whole time?
Well, we went back to the office to, start getting the first early numbers coming in. And, the first booth results to come in from our scrutineers was this, small little booth called Green Meadows. I think, 180 or 200 people vote there. And we got blown away there in 2019, smashed. And the result came in and we'd drawn level with Labor. And that was, 90, it was 90 votes each. It was an infinitesimal booth. But I was like, damn, that's peculiar. And then, like, the next three booths that came in, we won outright. Like, Carina Heights, like, this, like, booth that Labor got over 40% in the last election. We blew them away and won there. And, yeah, a bunch of booths started coming in where we thought, you know, for us to win, we needed to get some good swings but not actually win the booth outright. And, yeah, that first hour I started to – obviously something massive was happening. And at first I was excited and then terrified. And then, yeah, it took me about – after that, the big question was whether or not the Liberals would fall into third and their preferences would elect Labor. It was sort of funny because we got to the situation where we thought maybe we'd done too well, like, because we just annihilated the Liberal vote. And I was like, oh no. But, yeah, and it was the first few hours on that night, it was clear that something pretty amazing was going on. But it's all been – I've been quite delirious since then in a way. Like it's still only slowly sinking in. And it's strange as well because you – the person you are before and after, I think this is the case for a lot of people, like it feels – it's funny how elections have the capacity to feel like they change political reality a little bit very quickly and almost overnight. The potential – for our movement now has just like doubled or tripled in capacity. And it's I think a lot of people are still contemplating what all of this means, but obviously it's very good.
Yeah.
Well, in the media coverage over the last week, you know, again, better late than ever. Full credit to some of the media getting on board and trying to lay it out. Again, I think we talked about it last week. The ABC.
Who are the Greens and what do they stand for? The ABC.
And what do they
do? That. Yeah.
Oh, my parliament has all these Greens in it. What are they? But do you think anyone's got it? Like, because I've seen some pretty fucking cooked takes across the board. In the ABC 7:30 story you did, there was a commentator from the Australian Institute for Progress. I have no idea who the fuck they are, who that guy was.
Yeah, and
he was basically
that guy?
Saying they weren't talking about climate change. And so the Greens became less radical this election, and that's why they won. I guess they moved closer to the centre, and that's how they pulled out this win. There's been a lot of focus on, local issues, so therefore it's not real politics or whatever, it doesn't matter. And it's been like, you know, a genuine reporting on the ground game and the amount of door knocking that you've done, but in my view, a profound lack of analysis or interrogation of the kind of policies that you were talking about, the actual vision that you were laying out there. Do you think that anyone in the media has actually got it or people still trying to get their head around this thing?
Yeah, there's a few. And interestingly enough, a few journalists that have got closest to getting it are the two that went door knocking with us.
Yes.
Eden Gillespie from The Guardian spent 5.5 hours door knocking with me on a Saturday. Like, I was genuinely impressed at the stamina, to be honest, because I know from experience it's very tiring. But and then Rachel Mealy from the ABC, who did like a World Today coverage of it, both of them spent hours door knocking with me and Eden all day. And it was very interesting because you have those – it's the same experience that the volunteers sometimes get the first time they go door knocking, where they get to the end and being like, oh, you guys can
Holy
win.
Shit.
Because like you have that experience, like the first conversation I had with Rachel Mealy was this woman was like knocked on her door and she was immediately hostile. She was like, oh yeah, you all politicians promise everything. I hate you all. And then I handed her the flyer and I was like, oh yeah, no, fair enough. I think politics is completely bullshit as well and it's completely disconnected from our lives. And she ears pricked up and then she looked at the phone and she's like, I do like this dental thing though. And we got into this like 20-minute conversation about dental into Medicare and how transformative it would be for her and, you know, the fact that private health insurers are holding back, you know, donate millions of dollars to the major political parties and it's against their interests to make sure we can all go and get it to see a dentist for free. And she just spent $2,000 on the dentist and it put her in a lot of financial stress. We were walking down the stairs and Rachel's like, if I didn't know any better, I think you'd set up that conversation. And so I think those – and then Ben Smee from The Guardian I think got pretty close to getting him as well. And I think some saying that outlet. And interestingly enough, Michael McKenna from The Oz, I think he's the bureau chief at The Oz.
My friend.
Yeah. He it's sort of funny. Like I think instinctively understood the anti-establishment aspects of it and had like reported – actually did okay report, like good reporting on the door knocking aspect of the campaign and the politics of it. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of a lot of journos that haven't got it at all. And I think this is, it's sort of funny because one of the arguments we make about politics, what we've seen is a hollowing out of political institutions and a disconnect between civil society and politics. And the media is not immune to that. It exists and operates within that same political society. And so you've even watched these commentators try to explain what's happening, and they lurch towards this, you know, it's a teal thing, or it's entirely climate. Oh yeah, you know, the Greens have become moderate and completely incapable of understanding that potentially maybe what's happening is that there is some sort of like genuine social movement going on the ground, and it's a complex set of material and social interests that can't be captured by a particular like sentence run by someone in the media. And that disconnect also means that the media increasingly not having as much influence over elections and politics as well. And that much was clear. Like, you know, we won on the primary vote in Griffith and got barely not much media attention at all. Like it's becoming increasingly irrelevant.
Well, I think it's because all the people in Griffith became rich now, and they're all affluent, and so they're really comfortable, and they don't have to worry about anything else but just climate change. So actually, good. That's the impression I got from some Labour hacks. It's like, good, glad you got the inner city. Don't even want it.
Yeah, that's right.
I oscillate between wanting to get into arguments with some of these Labour people and be like, you genuinely don't understand. But then I'm sort of like, well, if you want to believe that, then fine, because it just means that you're never going to be able to relate to what's actually going on the ground. It's so interesting as well, because one of the things, again, a lot of the media don't really pick up on, it's like if there's one thing, you know, like we talked about young people, and there were a lot of young people voting for us, and that was massive. But the underlying material relation that is 50% of the electorate are renters. Like,
You
know, and
including yourself, we should make it clear.
That's it. And that material relation, which by and large is occupied by young people, this lack of not when you don't own an asset while assets are increasing and wages are stagnating, you are in a highly exploitative part of the economy. And the number of conversations we door knocked renters who otherwise were completely disengaged from politics, who you would talk about rent caps, like our training for our volunteers, we call them masterclasses. One of the trainings we ran was entirely how to talk and relate to people who are otherwise disengaged but who are renters. And basic conversation was, oh, do you have any issues? Oh, no, not really. Oh, do you rent or own here? Oh, yeah, I rent. And has your rent gone up recently? Yeah, it has. Well, that sucks. Well, we want to cap rent increases because we think it's bullshit that your rent can go up by $100 at the end of your lease. And bam. And, yeah, it's, again, this unwillingness to contemplate that people might be voting for the Greens because they see it as a way of voting in their material interests. From a class position, I find so interesting, you know, and obviously a lot of people are voting for climate change as well. But, you know, again, I think everyone wants this one sentence explanation for what happened. And it's like everyone's rich, everyone cared about climate change. It's basically the teals, and just none of it's the case. I sort of think journos should all have to go an hour of door knocking before they report on anything.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's like an extrapolation of that thing of the fact that, for example, in the ABC coverage of the election or the makeup of parliament, it still will just have the ALP and then the coalition seats and then other. And I know a lot of people like get annoyed about that. They're like, well, other, what the fuck does that mean? But that is kind of like that plays out in the way that the media talk about what has happened this election. And they can't grasp that. Yeah, there could be anything. Like if the Teals are winning and the Greens are also winning in Queensland, they're like, okay, that must be the same thing.
Yeah.
Like they can't imagine that. And that's definitely been one of the most frustrating things for me, the fact that they want that to be a thing so badly. And so they look at Ryan and they see that Libby won in Ryan and they're like, well, she's a woman who cares about climate change in like a pretty well-heeled kind of electorate that was formerly a Liberal seat. Never mind the fact that the other Liberal seat that we're potentially going to win is going to be won by, like a young renter, like retail worker, or the fact that you have won a seat from a fucking Labour shadow minister, or the fact that we've got like a teacher in Gladstone winning in the Senate. Like that all just falls away because that's not the narrative that they want to go with. And it's so fucking frustrating.
I've become so zen about it these days because the political project – because the political project that we're building is explicitly stands in opposition to so much of that political and media establishment, that there's a degree to which, you know, they either they learn or they become irrelevant. And like, if you think about it, you know, there's now the entirety of the metropolitan Brisbane potentially is going to be held by three lower house Greens MPs and offer politics that much of the media don't understand. And, you know, and the other thing to say as well is about Brisbane, Ryan and Griffith. One of the other things we observed, like the other material relation we observed, even among in middle-class areas, was parents with kids worried about their future. And it wasn't just like, it was a genuine anxiety about climate change, but it was also housing affordability because even relatively well-off middle-class families, it's very difficult if they have two or three children to, what, pay for all of their deposits to,
all
for
of
them
their, yeah.
to get into the housing market. And the number of, like, people who were coming over to us because we explicitly wanted to phase out negative gearing, for instance, or build those, you know, $300,000 homes that people could buy was huge. And again, this speaks to the inability of the media to understand how material politics might work as well. Like, parents were voting, even middle-class parents who there might not be, they don't necessarily stand to benefit out of those housing policies or climate, well, they certainly do out of the climate policies, are voting in the interest, material interest of their kids. And again, there's, I get this frustration that the media also then always report on values, like the, you know, values of integrity and things like that, and really struggle to come to terms with the fact that maybe there are people voting in their own collective material interests. And as if that's a bad thing, as if that's not actually how politics should work. And yeah, it's there's a, always also sections of the left that always struggle with that as well, like this concept we have to relate to people's values, which I just don't think actually is how people change their mind or relate to the world, but certainly is how the media do, well, a lot of it anyway.
This is what I thought that the article, I mean, if folks are interested, I think we should put a link in the show notes to the article that Liam, your campaign manager, wrote in Green Left about how we won Griffith, but in particular, him pointing out, like, yes, you know, climate change played a part, but it wasn't just climate change and it wasn't just integrity. And it's true, I think, that the calls for an ICAC really encapsulate, like, that kind of, yeah, the thing from the people who just don't get it. And there was a particular paragraph that I was just like, that is such a great way of putting it, where he says, personally, I feel an ICAC would not change much for a single mother in social housing or a young couple trying to find a rental. It would be a good thing to have, but it's often fetishized by progressives who would prefer not to be embarrassed by the actions of other members of the political class they identify with. Like,
I know your kids are struggling and I know you can't afford rent, but don't worry. No one is calling someone else Voldemort. It's all right. We have a better class of politics now.
Yeah.
We're doing things differently. Everyone's everyone within the ruling class is nicer to each other. Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny, isn't it? I mean, there was definitely a layer of people who cared about an ICAC. Like, and the degree to which, like, having a bunch of politicians hauled before some public forum and, like, found to have committed criminal acts. Like, there's a degree to which, like, I think that would probably, especially if they have committed crimes, would be a good thing. But, yeah, I mean, I think this also speaks to a misunderstanding of how power works or how people, how you might manifest power in society. Like, there's an assumption that the reason, for instance, that there's all this poverty or, you know, housing stress or people are leading really tough lives is because there is, like, a top-level corruption in the system. And that if only
the system's not working properly, the system's broken, like,
exactly. If only the system functioned in a fair, balanced way, then everyone would get what they needed out of politics. Whereas that's not the case. You could have, you know, like, everyone could be on their best behavior in parliament and they would still be voting for desperate cruelty for the vast majority of people. And that the way power manifests, certainly through the major parties, is not just through donations or, you know, like, obvious corruption, but is that they, both parties, these certainly the Liberal Party and increasingly, and for a long time, I'd argue the Labor Party as well, to sit back in the state government, is that they are institutionally geared by both state pressures from within the state, also from, you know, lobbyists and their relations to capital, often to act in those interests, because they see the national interest, for instance, is the profitability of those big corporations. And they certainly don't see it's clear they don't see the national interest, for instance, in ensuring that that single mum in social housing gets what she needs to live a good life. You know, there was the 7:30 report last night, and there's a woman pregnant living in a caravan because with her family just about, you know, moments away from giving birth because there's no affordable housing anywhere. And, like, there's a massive social crisis. But as long as, you know, inflation's kept under control and the profitability of large corporations continues to be okay, then that's the national state interest. And that sort of power, breaking that sort of power, has much more to do with organizing people on the ground and building the sort of people-powered movement we've been building over the last few years to a certain scale, and certainly more than, for instance, a federal ICAC, because much as it would be, I think, useful in some ways.
There was a real, in the Albanese campaign too, there was a real America is already great vibes, you know, like Australia is this great country that's just been corrupted by the by the bastards in the Morrison, in specifically the Morrison government, not the Liberal Party, okay? Because Howard, whether you agree with him or not, you know, is a man of conviction or whatever that bullshit was. But it's like, no, these specific people that we're trying to turf out in this particular election, they're the baddies. Get rid of them, get the goodies in, and don't change too much, but sort of tinker around the edges and everything will be fine, yeah.
Well, yeah, and even the Teals being like, we need to restore the Liberals. You know, the Liberal Party has kind of lost its way, and we need to restore Liberal values. Like, that's a lot of what's behind the Teal thing. But I think it's interesting, you know, talking about a desire to actually undo the grip that, you know, capital has on every aspect of our political system, or to just even redistribute wealth in any way. That's not something that obviously the Teals brought to the election. And I don't really know what to make of this, but there's kind of the parallel stories of Simon Holmes a court throwing however much money Climate 200 put into that. And then there's Clive Palmer also spending $100 million and getting – is he going to get one in the Senate?
One Senate for Victoria, I think,
like,
yeah.
One seat. But it's like, I don't know, maybe – why did money really have a part to play in, like, in the Teal race? Was it something else? Can you buy a seat? I don't know. What do you think it tells us about money in politics, I guess?
Well, I think money obviously has a part. I think the Teal story has much more to do with the disintegration with the Liberal Party as, like, a social and political project. And, you know, where you intervene in certain, moments in politics and civil society, obviously money can have an effect because it can turbocharge a message or a politics that already is has a potent effect on a community. So I just think that it's pretty obvious that there was, you know, the Teals, I would argue, and I think a few people I've seen online argue as well, are the manifestation of the slow disintegration of the old two-party system in Australia. Like, the Liberal Party emerged in reaction in the early 20th century to the rise of the labor movement and its dominance. You know, you had the Protectionist and Free Trade Party putting aside their differences and becoming a united party precisely to stop the power of organized labor and the Labor Party. And as the Labor Party have no longer really exist as a threat, well, if they ever did, but they certainly don't now, the warring factions within the Liberal Party, this sort of like, old sort of like, protectionist section maybe embodied in the Nationals and more conservative Liberals compared to the sort of metropolitan, like, cosmopolitan capital section of Liberals that do want free trade, but they might actually have some forms of social progression coming into massive contradiction. And that contradiction has been resolved in this instance by the emergence of the Teals. And money's probably helped in the sense that they had you need money to be able to intervene in that moment. But I think sometimes money in politics is overstated. And I always get frustrated as well because the implicit assumption that money in politics somehow is going to have this outsized effect is somehow that people, and media always do this, assume that people are dumb and stupid and can be manipulated, which is not the case. Like, having talked to a lot of people over the last 14 months, people are experts in their own lives and they really do get it. And trust is built both ways in these sort of political movements and those relations. There's a reason Palmer didn't do so well.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think money in politics is obviously there's a degree to which it can be damaging, but I think its effect is, as you were probably alluding to, Emerald, is significantly overstated.
He's such a fucking idiot, though. Like, doesn't he know? Like, if he spent half of that much money and directed it at a handful of seats or at, like, a smaller number of races, like, I'm not saying that he would definitely win.
Are we giving strategic advice to Clive Palmer on this podcast?
Because, of course, in 2019, the narrative was, oh, he's doing this in order to help to fuck over Labor or whatever. But now they weren't even running on that in 2022, right? Because they despise the major parties. Their whole sort of, you know, they hated the Liberal National Coalition for doing lockdowns as much as anybody else. And Craig Kelly defected from the Liberals, obviously. So I think he, like, does sincerely believe that he was going to take over the country and elect Craig Kelly.
Yeah, because they banked entirely on this fucking, like, fleeting micro issue that was always totally fucking overblown. And, yeah, I mean, we were all scared of it at one point. We were all like, fuck, is there going to be this massive, like, protest vote against vaccinations and lockdowns?
Nope.
And absolutely not.
No freedom, thank you. Australia said no to freedom.
$100 million is an insane amount of money to spend.
It's a lot of money, Max.
So much. Let's talk about the old. Apparently there were some other parties involved in this election, and apart from the Greens, boring, don't want to talk about it. But Labor Party did win with a swing against the lowest primary vote in the history, blah, 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 blah. It is, again, remarkable, I suppose. They got a lower primary vote the last time they are forming government. They are forming a majority government. They're on track for that, and that will be the situation, it seems. I suppose the question I have for you, Max, is like, could we say that Labor's strategy, small target strategy, worked in this election? Obviously, they have won government, so on a whole bunch of fronts, you could say yes. But I suppose, was it as necessary for them to be as hollowed out and as shit as they were? What do we make of the Albanese campaign of momentum in 2022?
Well, if they're wanting to, I mean, the first thing to say is this is an incredibly, like, tenuous control on government. Like, even if they do end up getting to 76 seats, it might be by a one or two seat majority, right? And I think it's potentially one of the first times in Australian political history someone's won from opposition with their primary vote going backwards. to the extent that they benefited from the disintegration of the Liberal Party, I suppose they stumbled it over the line, but for what, I suppose, is the major question. And it does to me, you know, and especially the swings we managed to get off Labor in places like Griffith, it does say to me that over the next 3 years, it's going to be interesting to watch how the Labor Party relates to the housing crisis, to the cost of living crisis, to climate change, because I think there's even the people that did end up voting for them are going to expect some sort of positive change, but you're not really hearing much.
They changed the flags. Flags have changed. They got the flags in them.
Yeah, that's it. And, like, I mean, certainly the people we spoke to, when it was dental and to Medicare or free university and TAFE and free childcare, there was a broad social consensus, I would argue, around a Scandinavian-style social democracy, which, like, even the ABC Vote Compass recognised the sort of centre-right. I think the stagnation you saw in the major party's vote was that people did want to vote for change. And if the Labor Party had, I don't think they're capable of doing it, to be honest, but if they had offered that sort of change, I think you would have seen a massive surge in their vote. And so for me, over the next few years, it feels like there is a strong desire in society to push for that sort of politics. They just need to be given the opportunity to do so. So, look, yeah, whatever. I mean, I don't think you're going to see Labor do much over the next 3 years. I hope I'm proved wrong, and hopefully we're able to put a little pressure on them in the Senate. But really, to me, it says it reinforces the urgency to continue expand the sort of campaigning capacity we've built in Brisbane across the country, because I think there's a lot of people crying out for that sort of longer term, more transformative vision. They just need to hear it and have a chance to relate.
What do you
it.
Think, Emerald? Because I think I was saying to you on the phone earlier in the week, it's like we saw all the attacks that we were told would come if Labor were to have a more ambitious policy. Okay, so they didn't. They've backed in these stage three tax cuts, which will give $9,000 tax cuts to people like Max Chandler Mather as an elected MP from 2025.
True.
I noticed you haven't mentioned them.
They'll spend it on free. some of our community campaigns.
All right, very good.
Yeah, you've done better.
So they said, yeah, we'll back in the tax cuts, and then they can't attack us as high taxing. Well, what do you know? It's a sneaky carbon tax. It's a housing tax. Tax, 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 tax. There's a hole in your budget, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Yes.
There's a hole in your budget?
There's a hole in your budget, jinx. Jinx. So, of course, all those attacks are rolled out. And it is sort of – I'm sure that the – boffins at Labor HQ are patting themselves on the back and saying, we fucking did it. Our strategy was right all along. But I think there is a much stronger argument to suggest that they absolutely could have won with a bigger, bolder, more left-wing platform this time around. Both the time factor, the narrative in those attacks running out of steam, they kind of exposed vows out of a hole they are. That would be my position. But of course, some might say, of course you'd say that, Tom. But that's my thoughts.
And if they, I mean, really, if they are sitting in HQ patting each other on the back and going, yep, we did it, we're great, like, they're idiots because, yeah, their vote's gone backwards and they're in serious fucking danger.
Whoa.
Oh, that's the name of our podcast, incidentally.
Damn.
But, yeah, like, clearly, no, that is the whole thing that we've been saying the entire time is that you can't stop your enemies attacking you by being more like them or pretending, like, trying to be more like them. You just need to defend your actual fucking policies. And I was thinking about this in the context, actually, of the attacks on the Greens. And we ran, an incredibly bold and quite radical platform, probably the most transformative that we've ever run, certainly in a federal election. And to be honest, I don't really know that we got that many attacks on our policies. And even I wanted to talk to you about this, Max, because even in terms of attacks, I think a lot of us got to the end of this campaign, particularly in Queensland, where we just finished, we had a state election where we were absolutely, pummeled with attacks that left the party quite fucking traumatized. And we were all waiting the whole time for the attacks to come. And they never really came. And I'm like, is that because Labor realized that they didn't work? Because last time they tried that in South Brisbane, we won. Could they just not think of anything? Were they too distracted? Like, what happened?
Yeah, I mean, they tried in Griffith. It's just,
well, they did, yeah, but like so weakly.
Yeah, I think, I mean, a few things to say here. Like in the state election, the Queensland Resource Council certainly went after us in a very aggressive way over our royalties policy. I think federal elections are also just bigger. Like, unless, you know, state elections, there's less seats, smaller media outlets, and there's a degree to which at that level there's just more noise and things going on, and it's harder to focus in on individual seats and run very specific attack campaigns. Although, you know, there was a few that occurred from the Liberal and Labor side. You know, I think the broader thing to say here as well is that I don't think, you know, there's this concept that neoliberalism changed the way people think about politics. And so, you know, you have to, this part of the small target strategy is people are generally economically conservative. I think probably part of the reason that the attacks didn't come is because people realize that our platform is broadly very supportive. Like taxing big corporations, a 6% tax on billionaires to do dental and mental health into Medicare or free uni and TAFE, for instance, or building a lot of public and social housing, is probably broadly supported by the large cross-section of Australian society. That was certainly our experience. And so it's very difficult, especially, you know, when people are sort of crying out for that, especially as the cost of living crisis and housing crisis started to bite and the existing economic model was clearly ruining people's lives and still is. Probably attacking us on those terms, the hardheads probably realised would only platform our message. And certainly that's been our strategy in the past. And I think that in terms of Labor's success or failure, they have failed to arrest their secular decline in their vote. Like this is one of their lowest primary national primary votes in their party's history, And they have still not been able to solve the massive problem with their party, the same one facing the Liberal Party, which is their votes are in secular decline, like in constant irreversible decline at a federal level, even and a bit at a state level. Which I don't think they're going to be able to necessarily going to be able to stop, which makes me excited actually about our project because it's abundantly clear to me, our politics and the platform we ran on is actually the common sense for a lot of people we speak to, and B, when you reach people with it and you relate your platform to their material interests and issues, people vote for it. which says to me that the only barrier to us getting over the line now is our capacity to run these sort of campaigns in other seats. So I feel quite hopeful about the whole thing.
I feel hopeful about the collapse of the Labour Party, yeah.
Well, I feel hopeful about the collapse of the Liberal Party. I mean, I think as long as where Labour loses seats, we win them. I think that's good.
Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly.
Because it changes the balance of forces in Parliament and society.
Yeah, and because that's right. Like Labour, obviously, they're shithouse. They are going to continue to be shithouse. They're straight into government and turning back boats and, you know, backing in fossil fuel projects. We're now looking at the fact that they're like, oh, the Liberals have left us with so much debt. Maybe we actually can't even pay for the fucking tiny things that we said we would maybe do because we're unwilling to tax corporations or billionaires to do so.
Those tax cuts were legislated.
And
a government can't undo a legislation that's been done before. Name me one example of a party being elected to government and undoing something that the previous government just did. Like just one example within the last decade. You can't see? Snookered.
The last decade? Well, speaking of climate change, I think you put this question in here, Tom, and maybe this is something that has come up. Will we... Because the Greens now do have, or we're looking to play a significant role in the Senate, at least. And when it comes to climate stuff and things like that, do you think we could see Labor and the LNP on that bipartisan, you know, fossil fuel ticket working together to get shit like that through the Senate?
Certainly, we've seen in other democracy, like comparable democracies around the world, the Grand Coalition, which is like, you know, the CDU and the German Social Democrats formed. Sort of cohesive coalitions to hold off the rise of third parties and the Greens. So I don't think it's beyond the realms of possibility. Peter Dutton, as opposition leader, may foreclose that possibility. But it's true to say that the policies of the Labor and Liberal Party when it comes to the expansion of coal and gas and subsidies for the fossil fuel industry have very, very similar policies. I mean, whether or not I think there's probably some capacity for negotiation between the Greens and Labor in the Senate. And like certainly the Greens have said open and ready and, you know, to engage in that negotiation. But I think the other thing hopefully will be that Labor realize that they like part of the reason that they suffered swings against them to the Greens in seats where we ran hard was precisely because people even people who you wouldn't be surprised to learn, you know, might be surprised to hold this position, do want substantial action on climate change because the bushfires and the floods were very material examples of what happens when you don't do that. And certainly I think people would rather those subsidies be spent on like dental or housing than padding the profits of mining corporations already making billions and billions of dollars. Like I even chatted to coal FIFO workers who we could completely agree that mining corporations should pay way more in tax so we could fund a transition plan. It's a pretty commonly held view. It's sort of funny that I've never really thought that Labor or Liberals' position when it comes to coal and gas are to do with voters so much as they are to do with their inextricable links to the fossil fuel industry. So I suppose, easing them away from that in a calm and negotiated way.
Is that the line that they've given you?
Meanwhile, stable, secure.
Yeah, that's it.
Working with Labor. I mean,
I'm sorry, just before, and sorry, might relate, so excuse me. But I think it's important to underline the fact that to Labor, not getting something through, doing their climate policy without any influence from the Greens whatsoever is a political goal, okay? That is something that is important to them. I think it's fair to say that, yeah, again, looking at the green slide, looking at Greensland, fuck it. It's a thing.
I wish you wouldn't keep using green slide. Like people are starting to tar me with the same brush and they're saying that I support green slide.
Get on
and
board,
I want
bitch.
On the record that I don't support green slide. It's a silly word.
No matter what some Labor folks, but, you know, the Greens are an existential threat to Labor. And, you know, because of their little brains, they're terrified of repeating the Gillard minority government lesson. So they will view the idea of minimizing any Greens' influence on their climate policy as a political achievement that is actually important to them, I think, while in this first term of government. So, you know, with that in mind, despite the results of the election, what I think would could broadly be described as a mandate for greater climate action than what Labor was offering, you know, that they're going to work against it as much as possible. I mean, the truly fucking crazy thing about them getting a lower primary vote is that, like, more people voted for you when you had a 2% higher emissions reduction target in 2019 than they did this time around. So even your own voters surely should let you know that they want you to push further and faster and actually do something that will keep us to 1.5 degrees warming as opposed to the horror show that you've put out this time around. But anyway, so that's all I want to say.
Yeah, you know, there's still reasons to hope, I reckon. But, look, I mean, I think the other thing to say around all of this as well is that if we understand politics as like competing bases of power, the fossil fuel industry obviously wields an enormous amount of power within both the Liberal and Labor Party. And if we are going to be able to counteract that, I think taking hope and inspiration from what's happened in Brisbane in terms of the capacity to organise and not just doorknock but run those community campaigns, like, that is a real form of power.
No, totally. Yeah.
It's a nascent infant form of power, but nonetheless an important one. And I think the speed with which that's going to grow over the next few years and decade is probably going to be the thing that determines whether or not we do get really substantial action on climate change, in particular the key question of phasing out of coal and gas, because you know, emissions reductions, like, really important, but Australia's the third biggest exporter of fossil fuels. And as far as Labor's concerned, that doesn't count towards emission reductions. That's what they call
Scope three emissions.
Which is so dumb. Like, it's such a bureaucratic thing. It's like, oh, no, if we dig up the coal and it's burnt elsewhere, that doesn't actually count.
Yeah.
And it's bureaucracy running into the harsh iron fucking wall of reality around that. But that's going to be the key question, breaking the fossil fuel industry's control over Australian politics. But I reckon it'll take a little while.
Yeah, well, hopefully not too long, because we need to fucking hurry up. So please get onto it, Max. But, yeah, I mean, I have a couple of questions before we finish up, because, I mean, the first one I'm interested in is, do we think, like, either Labor or even the Liberals, maybe the Teals, maybe new insurgent micro-parties will start trying to copy the way that we campaign, and can they do it?
Yeah, they might. Part of the formation of what's going on here, and, like, when you like, and the reason that people are drawn to our movement, obviously, is not just climate change and integrity. It is those base material interests, like the number of nurses and teachers and renters and just people getting involved because they see this as a project run by people like them and of them, I think is relatively unique to the politics embodied in the Greens these days, and certainly in Queensland. And that's very difficult. I think that's very difficult. That will be very difficult for others to replicate as long as they continue to reject that sort of broader material politics that we campaigned on. And so I think there will always be limitations around that. And I think even if they understood all our training techniques and our, like, aspects of our community campaigning, at the end of the day, if you go to the door and you still don't have a policy to cap rent increases or bring dental into Medicare, there's just going to be a severe limitation. Like, part of the reason our politics work and our organizing strategy works is precisely because we called it life knocking, where we train people in the capacity to just have long form conversations about people's lives. Where are they struggling? How are they going at work? What's going on in their lives? Are they able to afford the rent? That's a key part of the puzzle. The other part of the puzzle that fits into the other is saying how you would alleviate and improve that and then provide a narrative around to why you think they're in that position, which is because billionaires and big corporations have wielded so much power and wealth that they suck it out of society and away from people that need it and deserve it. Without having that aspect of politics, I think people are going to struggle to build the sort of movement that we're doing here.
Having said that, please, any Liberal Democrats, Clive Palmer, One Nation, please go door knocking. Please go door to door in your local community and try and sell your horrible ideas to your friends and neighbours. I highly encourage you to do that. I think it'll work out great. Tell them that climate change isn't real, that we need a royal commission into Islam, and that billionaires should pay more tax. Should pay less tax. And really, I'd love to see how that goes.
Yeah. They might be in for a rude shock. But, yeah, look, I mean, because there's the door knocking side of things, and there is, as you said, there's the community campaign side of things, which really I think, you know, Brisbane and Ryan to an extent did this, but that was a real kind of core pillar of the Griffith campaign, was effectively emulating what it's like to have a Greens MP and a Greens electorate office that can run something like flood recovery when it's needed, or, you know, a community campaign about a new park instead of a development, or the flight noise, or whatever it is. And that, I think, is what, particularly from a Queensland context, maybe this makes sense to me, because like I work for a Queensland MP who theoretically in Parliament has no fucking power. Like there's a majority government, there's a single house of government of Parliament. And so like theoretically they can't do anything legislatively. And yet like people re-elected Michael in 2020 because of what he had done, been able to do outside of Parliament. And I think we've always said that, you know, the most important work that he's done is outside of Parliament. And so even where I think a lot of people might be, and I imagine probably a lot of media have been asking you this over the last few days, where you didn't win balance of power and you said that that was how you're going to do everything, is you're going to win balance of power. And so you don't have that. So how are you going to do anything? But I know that, like, I imagine you're getting excited thinking about all the shit you are going to do with your new office.
Yeah.
Like,
oh, Emerald, absolutely. Like, I think the other thing to say is, like, our campaign, one of the things I loved about our campaign was the effort we made in not just political education for our volunteers, but political education around our strategy to our broader community and voters as well. Mm. We talked about balance of power, but we also said there's a chance that we don't get balance of power. And in that instance, change is hard and takes time. And we talked about broadening the scope of political debate as one of the first ways of changing things. We talked about building power in the community. We talked about the power of winning an incumbent Labor MP the effect it has on the Labor Party and the way it thinks about politics. People are bought into that. But also, yeah, exactly. Like the things that we're thinking about now are running free meal services, expanding our community gardens, expanding our work around pushing back against bad development, trying to get a moratorium on the sell-off of public housing in the electorate, running renters' rights campaigns, like real material things that improve people's lives in the immediate sense. And I said this before, like I genuinely, like I, you know, at the start of the Griffith campaign, like I got the inspiration around incorporating the community arm of the campaign into Griffith from the work that you guys had done in Michael's office. It was like, well, why can't we just do that even if we don't have an MP's office? But I also think it's the future of the Greens, because we can't just be a political party if we want to change the world. We need to be a social party as well. And why I mean that, embedded in those communities and being part of people's lives outside of the electoral cycle, where we prove that we can improve people's lives directly and deliver services and help them when their lives are tough outside of government. And you know, the broader and bigger capacity we're able to do that means that when you come up to elections, increasingly it's not about that last 6 weeks, and it certainly was for Griffith. It's about an endorsement of a much broader political and social strategy. And certainly I am, I'm bloody tired at the moment, but the thing that gets me animated, as you can probably tell, is thinking about what we're going to be able to do over the next 3 years in terms of expanding that. The pitch is, if you move into Griffith, you should know that we have your back. Like if you're struggling to pay for food for that week, struggling with the landlord, struggling to pay the rent, like whatever it may be, we should be there to have your back. And that's going to be the goal.
That's so
nice. I think we're going to be able to pull off.
Yeah. And I think it is worth acknowledging, I mean, really quickly, that also was that a lot of that comes from Jono. It goes right back to the start. And I did love that 7:30 report on our wins in Brisbane focused on Jono, where it started in the Gap Award when he was elected in 2016, and the fact that he is someone who was already active in grassroots community organizing and mutual aid, and brought that into office with him, and that really is like the foundation of this movement alongside the way that we connect with voters when we're campaigning and when we're not campaigning. That's what has allowed us to grow, and it's also what makes our movement so worthwhile.
Just for people watching on YouTube, I want to acknowledge the fact that I'm aware that it got really dark and creepy as the sun's been going down during this conversation, so I'm sorry to freak you all up. Very quickly, quick gay questions before you leave. Have you decided what you're going to wear in Parliament? This is really important. Are you going to wear a suit? Are you going to wear a T-shirt? What's going on?
I really don't want to wear a tie. I don't know what the rules are around that, to be honest. But
good question. I think you have to wear like a jacket or a tie, right?
Right. Well,
that's Queensland.
I'll wear a jacket. I've got some friends in the South Brisbane branch who said they want to do like a queer eye thing because they think I wear the same shirt too often.
That's fine. You're like a little character. You can be a character. I mean, if at any point in your life you are going to become solely like a two-dimensional caricature, like it's when you become an MP. So lean in, I say.
Yeah, just only blue.
Have you written your first speech yet? Do you know what you're going to say in your first speech?
No, I've got to still think about that. I don't even know when that happens. And it's not even clear necessarily when Parliament's going to sit. thinking about that bit is weird.
That's fucking wild. Thinking about like looking into the chamber and seeing like all three of you, potentially all four of you just sitting down there, it like my heart literally lurches because it's so exciting.
Well, I thought about this, right, because there's talk about how the independents and the crossbench want to improve the running of Parliament, right? So that includes getting rid of Dorothy Dix, is like just actually making the running of Parliament less fucked as it has been, you know, during the coalition rule. But I was like, no, we could have Greens asking other Greens Dorothy Dix's. No, shut up. I don't think that's how it works. Hey, Max, please inform the House how the two major parties are fucked and hollowed out and shit and how the future is green.
I mean, look, when the Greens are in government in 17 years' then we'll be able to do
We'll reinstate Dorothy Dix's.
Yeah, that's it.
All right, you're very busy, Max. Thank you so much for coming back on the show. It is a pleasure to see you again, and congratulations. I'm so stoked for both of you, as is the entire country and everyone listening to this podcast, that is for sure. Do you want to plug anything? Is there anything that people can do to sort of be part of the Max Chandler Mather experience, or as an MP for Griffith?
Or the Greens experience, maybe more broadly. Join the Greens if you haven't already. I think we'll have certainly more to say about ongoing stuff that we plan to do in Griffith and across Brisbane and Queensland. But for now, maybe just bask in the glory for a little bit. Join the Greens, get involved wherever you are across the country. It genuinely feels like politics has turned a corner. And there's a horizon out there now based on a lot of hard work that we could reach. And I feel very excited about it.
Greenslide.
Greensland.
Thanks so much, Max.
Hola, Greensland.
I'll let you guys sort that out. Bye.
It won't be easy under Albanese. There's a hole in your budget. Dear Labor. Taxes are coming for taxes with Labor.
Well, joining the Greens is certainly our main call to action, and we'll put the link in the show notes, but it's pretty simple. It's greens.org.au/join. And there's never been a more exciting time to be a Greens member, not just to be part of a fantastic movement, but also like we're a party with growing power. And if you are a Greens member, you get to have a say on shit because we also happen to be a grassroots democratic party, and you get to vote on a bunch of shit, have a say in consensus decision making. So yeah, join the Greens, be powerful.
If you don't like winning, then don't join the Greens, because you're not gonna have a good time. If you hate winning, then it's just like not the party for you, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Cheeky little plug for me, if I may. Tomorrow night in Melbourne, I'm doing a taping of a BBC radio comedy special. And it's me telling jokes about a topic that will be very dear to everybody's hearts who listens to this show. It's happening at the Comedy Republic. We've put a link in the show notes. Tickets are totally free because the BBC is very nice. There's still just a handful of tickets to the second show at 8 p.m. You just fill out the RSVP form in the show notes there and you can come along and we can all have a laugh. That's in Melbourne at the Comedy Republic.
You didn't say what it was about. Is it about climate change?
Maybe, maybe not.
Okay, cool.
I'm trying to keep the mystery alive. Yeah, it's about climate change.
Okay.
But it's funny. It's going to be funny.
Okay.
Now, you're fucking off. Tell the people what's going on here.
Oh, I'm going away. I'm going to the Philippines and South Korea in a couple of days, which means that I will not be here for, I think, is it 4 or 5 episodes? About a month. Sorry. We worked this out and I forgot. So I'm sorry. I won't be here, but I'll try and I'm going to be trying to send in little snippets so you can remember what my voice sounds like and we can maintain our parasocial relationship.
Yeah. Because I love you. Are there Greens parties in South Korea or the Philippines? Do we know?
Good question. I don't know. I think politics is pretty fucked in the Philippines at the moment. I don't really know what. Yeah.
That's certainly true. You'll be hearing Emerald over the coming weeks, and I'm going to be having some cool co-hosts join me to fill her gigantic shoes, and we will miss you very much, Emerald,
yeah,
of course.
My feet are enormous. Surprisingly large.
We will miss you, but we also know that you deserve a break because you've been working your goddamn guts out and winning. And winning's very tiring, so you need a little break.
Also
something really exciting that is coming up in the coming weeks is the Greens Party National Conference is happening at Trades Hall in Melbourne on June 11th and 12th. This is when people from parties, from all the state parties across the Greens Federation get together and presumably
have nerds together.
Have sex and do lots of drugs and celebrate the Green slide. So that's happening. If you're a member, you're very welcome to come along. Can non-members come? I guess not. No. I don't know how it works.
Good question. I don't think so. Like you might, I don't know, maybe if you ask permission to observe.
Yeah. Anyway. You probably don't want to if you're not a member, to be honest, but you should become a member and then come along. And we're going to be doing Serious Danger Live. It is a bummer that Emerald will not be joining us, but on the Sunday afternoon about 4 p.m., I'm going to be there doing a live show in front of the Greens National Conference. Again, celebrating the wins, talking about what the next parliament's going to look like, talking about the future. I think we're going to get some of the young Greens involved. Some guests, of course, Adam will be around the conference. Maybe we'll be able to get him on stage. Some of our new shiny MPs and senators might be able to join us as well. That's going to be really fun. So if you're free that weekend and you're interested and you're in Melbourne, then come along to that. But if not, don't worry, we'll bring you the audio of Serious Danger Live.
Cool, cool, cool. In the meantime, you can rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening now. In fact, you not only can, but you should. You can also support the show on Patreon, where if you do, chuck us $3 or you know, $2 a month and you can have a listen to our special new episode coming out. You can also follow us on @SeriousDangerAU on Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube. And for everything else, just go to SeriousDangerPod.com.
Bye, Emerald. Miss you already.
I miss you all.
Right.
Serious Danger, Australia.